This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show. You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio, heard weekdays from noon to one. Now, Fight Back with Libby Znaimer on Zoomer Radio.
Good afternoon and welcome. It's Wednesday. Time to talk about your health. And today's news puts in mind the old adage, if the U.S. sneezes, do we in Canada catch a cold? We're actually talking about the flu and other diseases that are easily prevented by vaccines. This week, as you heard in Jeremy's news, Donald Trump unilaterally changed both the lineup and the schedule of children's vaccinations. And he's come up with this, I think, nonsensical claim that combined immunizations dump too much liquid in children's bodies. I don't know. Even people in his own party are pushing back. So my question really is, what does this mean to us on the other side of the border? And there's also a positive development out of the States. The Senate has confirmed a new head of the Centers for Disease Control. It's the first time in a year or more than a year that there is a permanent person running that show. And she is a military veteran, a former deputy surgeon general, and someone who has run vaccination campaigns. So, sounds good. She's also Black and Jewish, and I hate to wonder how long she is going to last. Here at home, we're also talking ahead of the school year about e-scooter injuries, which are a scourge. There's also plenty of injuries resulting from unregulated helter-skelter use of all kinds of other micro-mobility devices. And apparently, this is not just a local phenomenon. I think it's something that's a problem around the world. I saw a study out of England, which says that people who ride e-scooters are three times as lucky to suffer brain injuries. So what do you think? And people, I'm anxious about your encounters, either using those things or, coming up against them. 866-744-740. That's our text line, our long-distance phone line. Also, 416-360-0740.
Now, time for The Medical Record.
And now I'd like to welcome Dr. Malcolm Moore, who is a medical oncologist at the Princess Margaret and former head of BC Cancer. Dr. Fahad Razak, a general internist at St. Michael's Hospital and Canada Research Chair in Healthcare Data and Analytics at the U of T. And Dr. Elisa Naiman, a family doctor practicing in Toronto. Hi, everyone. Welcome.
Hey, Libby.
Hi.
I want to start with Fahad, and I don't know what I want to start with first, the flu changes in the States and how they impact us, or those e-scooter injuries. But let's start with the flu.
Yeah, let's do vaccines. Look, I don't know how many more unkind things we can say about RFK Jr. and U.S. policy on this one, but I'll try and find something additional to say today. It's striking to me. I lived and worked for 5 years in the United States, trained in their medical system. It is a remarkable place for evidence and science and innovation, and to see what's happening now is just so discouraging, striking, disappointing, scary. And this drop in the vaccine schedule in kids, the U.S. government's own estimates from the CDC suggest millions of kids' lives saved since vaccine campaigns have started in the United States. They're taking away things from the schedule like hepatitis, RSV. These are all conditions that I think your physicians will have seen kids admitted with. And the idea that it's somehow lower burden for children to ask for them and their parents to come in multiple times. Remember, some of these vaccines we're trying to make it as easy as possible here.
Yeah.
Now they're asking him to come back multiple times, parents taking time off work, pulling kids out of school. They're making it harder. They know what happens when you make it harder. The evidence is very clear. Less vaccination happens. That's what happens when you make it harder. And at the same time, the appointment of someone who is very credible with Dr. Schwartz, she is very credible. Unfortunately, very credible people in this government have done abhorrent things. And, you know, in the questioning that the U.S. Senate had put her through, they asked her directly, if you are told to do something against science by RFK Jr., would you follow it? And her response was, he would never say anything that's against science. Like, don't believe your lying eyes. He would never say anything that's against science. So there you have it.
But Fahad, do you think there will be spillover of a drop in the vaccination rate south of the border here?
There will be spillover in the sense that we have the longest, undefended land border. We have millions of people who go back and forth in either direction. When one group is systematically less vaccinated, that means they will bring illness. Infectious illness does not respect geographic boundaries. It follows people. When people flow, the disease follows with it. However, this is a situation where the level of protection in Canada is fully under our control because these are vaccine preventable illnesses. So if Canadians are vaccinated, it doesn't matter how many Americans cross the border who are unvaccinated, we remain protected. The threat is we have also seen, unfortunately, declines in vaccination rates here in Canada. That creates pockets of vulnerability, susceptibility, which if you have more unvaccinated and infected people coming into the United States, that could then expose people here in Canada. So we can protect ourselves. It's within our authority, autonomy to do it. It means we have to get our vaccination rates back up.
Alisa, we've talked about this, and now there's something that's going to make it worse, I think.
When they had this press conference, I was just sitting there and listening to what he said, and I just couldn't believe the basic lies that he had. So, like, the VAT, we're injecting VATs, a vaccine, that's just, like, the most ridiculous thing I've ever heard, and that the size of, like, a soda. So it's not the size of a soda. It's 0.5 mils, okay? So it's not even 1 milliliter. It's 0.5 is being injected. I've talked many times about how difficult it is to vaccinate. The rhetoric now that exists and how it's portrayed by him that it's not safe, we need to protect the children, the babies, it's all lies. That's the truth. It's lies, and people will hear it and not understand or know the evidence to say that this is just a lie and that there is evidence to show that it's beneficial. It's one of the few things in medicine that on a population level has increased the health of a population, and he has just made my job so much more difficult to do. It's to have somebody come and space out the vaccines. Libby, do you know how hard it is to get people to come in and stay on schedule, especially during the winter when they're sick and we have to defer? It is so hard to get people to be caught up and to ask parents to take even more time off of work so that we can space out vaccinations, that the MMR vaccine, which only exists as an MMR vaccine and doesn't even exist in three different vaccines that it be given. What he is doing is dangerous. And I just go, oh my gosh, like, why is he saying, like, I can't believe what he's saying because it's really lies.
Well, yeah.
And he knows it.
We don't have that here, this move to separate them. It's interesting you say that they don't even exist separately. But as Fahad was saying, I mean, it's a pretty porous border, even though lately fewer people travel to the United States. And it's, I guess, a danger to everybody. I mean, Malcolm, when people are being treated for cancer, they really can be hit especially hard by the flu if it's transmitted. You're muted. Okay, Malcolm, you're muted. Can someone? Okay. Oh, are you there? Okay. We'll get back to Malcolm. Fahad, let's get to this e-scooter injury, which I was actually not that surprised to find is a problem, it seems, all over the world.
Yeah, I have to say, as someone who's been a cyclist for 25 years in Toronto, I am struck by how much less safe the cycle lanes and the sidewalks feel because of the rise of e-scooters. And I'm going to throw in e-bikes onto this as well, which are just zipping through people in a way that it's, you know, and I was speaking to some of my emergency room colleagues who are obviously seeing a rise in injuries from this as well. And it seems like it's the complete Wild West in terms of regulating these vehicles. Their vehicles, they are closer to motor vehicles than they are to pedestrian powered cycles in many ways. Some of these things are going 40 kilometers an hour and zipping through people on sidewalks and on bike lanes. Many of them don't even pretend to be have any human component of pushing anymore. Like, I was pushed off the bike lane in last week by someone who was just riding a motorcycle, basically, in the bike lane at this point.
Oh, so, they do that all the time.
They do it all the time, and they don't. I really feel like the ability to regulate them has been something that has far lagged the onset of them being used on the streets, and we're seeing injuries from them. We're seeing young kids and young adults coming in with high velocity injuries. We're seeing adults who are pedestrians or kids who are pedestrians being hit by them. And they're giving a general sense of chaos on the roads as they're zipping through sidewalks and roads, jumping back and forth between them.
Yeah. And, there's a blitz going on in Toronto, Elisa, but it's a 2-week blitz. And the problem is that this has been allowed to continue for so long without consequence, like so many other things.
I find those e-bikes with those delivery people, like, just, they're very aggressive when you're on the road, and it feels very unsafe. I used to cycle a lot, and I did a lot of road cycling, and because this is already back over 10 years ago, and I would go outside of the city because I felt it was unsafe to actually cycle within the city. Yeah. And I can remember a time, like, when you're riding on the road, it's just so dangerous. I was with in a group of people in a cycling group, and we got cut off by a car who decided not to wait and was going to make a right turn. And I was the second or third rider. And I'm lucky I didn't go flying off of my handlebars, because just how dangerous it is to ride a bike now. And that was even before e-bikes. These e-bikes are just, they go so fast. They're zipping in and out of traffic. It's every time I'm driving, I'm like, oh, this is just crazy. Like, you know, Libby, my office is on Eglinton, and there was this boy who was riding his bike, and he was basically on one wheel going straight down Eglinton. And there was this pedestrian walking beside me, and he just looked at me like, what's with these people? Like, and I'm like, yeah, he's going to fall, and he's going to have a concussion, and if not, you know, suffer something worse. And I don't know what people think anymore. It's quite bad, and it's very dangerous, and really people do need to be careful. I've had patients come in with their scooter injuries where they hit a divot, they hit a pothole, they go flying, they have a concussion, they have a lot of soft tissue injuries. And then finally, some of them will learn that this is really a dangerous activity and they really shouldn't be doing it, and others continue. So, yeah.
Yep. Okay. I'm going to try Malcolm again. Are you there, Malcolm?
I'm here. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you. That's great. So I'm going to turn to a cancer related story, and it's about the relationship or the prevalence of people who have cardiac effects from cancer treatment, because there's a growing number of people who both get cancer treatment and survive cancer treatment.
Yeah, and as we bring in these, there are some conventional chemotherapy drugs where there is toxicity to the heart, and that's been well known for a long time. a lot of these new drugs that are coming in that we've talked about on the show are quite different. They're pills often. You take them every day They work in very different mechanisms, and they have a different spectrum of side effects. And there's actually now a specialty called cardio-oncology, which we find very helpful. It's cardiologists who are particularly interested in cancer patients and can give us advice on, in people with compromised cardiac function, how we manage them to try to give them the optimal cancer treatment. So I wouldn't say it's a tsunami, which is what the article said, but I do think it's a field that's growing, and it's very helpful for us to have specialist cardiologists who help us with our cancer patients.
I saw one of those specialists, and it was extremely helpful. Dr. Hussam Al-Qadr, he was great. And I'm wondering how many of these side effects would be permanent and how many just temporary during the treatment?
It really honestly depends on the drug. Obviously, the worst ones are what we call the cumulative toxicities, where each time you get a treatment, the damage to the heart or whatever organ it is gets gradually worse. And so we have, for certain drugs, we have thresholds where we would say you can't go beyond this many treatments because the damage to the heart will not repair. And typically, when you damage the heart, it doesn't repair. So it is something we're very careful about, and we do a fair amount now of monitoring people's cardiac function when they're on longer-term treatments, because the other thing with many of these newer drugs is people tend to stay on them for longer periods of time.
Mm-hmm. And is there a point, are you seeing new points where people have to stop these drugs, which are, immunotherapy is amazing for a lot of people, and there are a lot of people who think they can stay on it for a very long time or do stay on it for a very long time.
There's definitely situations where if it was not for the damage to the heart, you would continue the treatment and you just have to stop it because, so yes. That is the case, not for every situation, but unfortunately, for most situations, there are alternatives, not always. But then you get into, I think, what you experienced, Libby, kind of the more unusual heart toxicities that you can get with immunotherapy. And typically with those, we would not be able to introduce the therapy again.
So it's kind of one step forward, two steps back. We have these great new drugs, and we're finding out that, well, they can have very bad side effects. Turning now to another story, and I found this very interesting partly because I feel like applauding people who actually are thinking about COVID-19 and how to prevent it as opposed to just trying to forget about it. And there was this clinical trial that we talked about with someone from Sunnybrook. And the idea of testing people in long-term care could prevent thousands of emergency room visits every year, so you don't give these respiratory viruses a chance to spread, and you get a quicker result. It seems like an easy fix. Am I being naive, Fahad?
No, it's great. So I'm delighted to see this. This was done in Ontario. It was done by researchers from our hospitals in the Toronto Academic Network, who I know extremely well. And it's really important. This is as we've talked about a lot in the last 5 years with you, Libby, the impact on long-term care that the pandemic had was a true national disgrace. And part of what drove that was the rapid spread of illness without diagnosis within those, helpless residents of long-term care. It was like a wildfire. And the ability to detect and isolate patients quickly is a major part of the containment strategy. And the typical turnaround time for a test like this for someone in long-term care would be days, 3 to 5 days. This test gives a result within an hour, right on site. So that means that you can isolate that person You can start therapy faster. Now, they were not able to show that they were able to reduce spread, and I would say that the study wasn't, we use the word powered, it wasn't big enough really to detect that signal. However, they did look at whether they could initiate treatment faster. It absolutely showed that. And it also showed that they had a roughly 10% lower chance of people ending up in the emergency room, which makes sense because you're detecting illness faster and you're treating faster. So I think overall, it's a really positive finding. It's working with an especially vulnerable group, segment of society. And I think it showed that you can do something here even when infectious disease starts to spread.
Malcolm, what's your reaction to this?
Well, I would slightly different, I think. So if you look at this, first of all, this study is an incredible undertaking. To do this kind of a study in nursing homes, which are not usually places you do clinical research, is a significant achievement. And I would imagine this was fairly costly. To be fair, though, the intention of this study, the primary intention was to see if on-site testing would affect outbreaks and the number of people who were infected. That was the primary endpoint of the study, and they weren't able to show any difference. The secondary endpoints were, could you affect the death rate from these infections? Unfortunately, they did not show that. So the one positive finding was the decreased visits to the emergency department. I think the question coming out of this is, does this mean that we should be routinely implementing on-site diagnosis in all the long-term care facilities in Ontario, and what the cost benefit for that would be? And I don't know the answer to that, but that's the question that comes out of this study.
Okay. Back to the vaccination question. I have an interesting question from Louis. And he says, why the difference in total vaccinations between the US, Canada, and Europe? He says, in the US, and I haven't checked his numbers, up to 72 cumulative doses from birth to age 18, Canada, 25 to 40, and a different one in every European country. So I think that's a reasonable question. Why the difference in all these different places? Who wants to take that?
I'm happy to start. So the first thing, so good, really good question, Louis. The first thing is, even that first number, 40 doses, 50, 60, 70 doses, that is using a way of counting that is designed to make the public think that we're injecting kids many, many times. This is a new this is new math from the Trump administration. They are taking a combined vaccine. So let's use the example of MMR, which has measles, mumps, and rubella in it. It's a single shot, but they're counting it as three because they're saying it's protecting you against three things. So it's three shots. So you can see they're using that to multiply the number of shots that are given to give you the sense that there's this, and then you hold up a pop bottle and you say it's a pop bottle amount of vaccine going. So it's part of this argument. So I just want to flag that because it's important because that is part of how they're reporting it. The next thing is the US different than other countries? The US, Canada, and Europe historically were actually very similar, and Canada remains very much middle of the pack compared to European Union countries about how many vaccines we give children. The US has now become systematically different than almost every other country by pulling back in this executive order in a way that creates a group of diseases which historically US kids have been protected against, hepatitis, RSV, et cetera, that will not be covered if this is fully implemented. And they often point to some Nordic countries and say, well, they have less vaccines there. Remember, we're talking about, let's use Denmark as an example, 6 million people, homogeneous, very wealthy, single-payer health system versus 350 million people, highly diverse, no systematic coverage of healthcare, and huge disparities across groups. So the value of vaccination in those two countries is very, very different. So that argument, I think, at its base as well, you're not comparing apples to apples when you're comparing the United States to Denmark. So it's what I'm saying is there's a bunch of very crafty, very intentional arguments that have been put together here to mislead people into thinking huge volumes of vaccines were so different than everyone else. Why don't we do this and this and this? It's a strategic, very smart, but very disingenuous strategy that is being followed here in the messaging.
Okay. I'm looking at the clock. We're almost out of time. And I'm getting some interesting texts on e-bikes, which, as we've said, are a scourge. E-bikes should be banned everywhere until this can be sorted out. They are very dangerous and not part of an exercise program. No, they certainly are not. And another text on e-bikes. Just the other day, I was prevented from using the sidewalk by an e-bike parked in the middle of the sidewalk and its rider sitting on the sidewalk beside his bike. He wanted me to wait a sec while he picked up food. I yelled at him like I was his grandma. Okay, that's not going to do it. So I hope all of you are not plagued with injuries resulting from that. I'm going to wrap things up now. Thank you so much, Dr. Malcolm Moore, Dr. Elisa Naiman, and Dr. Fahad Razak. And we'll talk again soon. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye.
Okay, we're taking a quick break. And when we come back, the woman behind the establishment of the new special First in Canada Hate Crimes Prosecution Unit, when we return.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio. Heard weekdays from noon to one. Oh, no. Fight Back with Libby Znaimer on Zoomer Radio.
Welcome back. Well, this week we've been talking about the establishment of the first in Canada hate crimes prosecution unit. Now, the impetus for this came from a private member's motion tabled by MPP Michelle Cooper in April. Now, not only do private initiatives rarely succeed, this one came to fruition in lightning speed, at least in political time. So people, you can call in if you have questions or comments, 866-744-7740, our text line, our long-distance phone line, 416-360-0740. And now I am joined by Ontario PC MPP Michelle Cooper, who represents Eglinton Lawrence. Hi, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me on today, Libby.
Okay.
Pleasure to be here.
I was going to say congratulations. Yesterday, we got some reaction to this move. And the first thing everyone said was good for MPP Michelle Cooper for getting this done.
Thank you. Thank you. I mean, I'm very excited about this. I was very honored to be able to bring this forward on behalf of our government and put this initiative and do this for the people of Ontario. So I am very happy to be here and so happy to make that announcement with Attorney General Doug Downey the other day to say that it has been implemented. So very proud of that.
Okay. Well, how did it come about? Did you do this in cooperation with the party or what?
So as an MPP, you get a piece of legislation and which is a private member's bill or motion that you can put forward in the legislature. So when I first got elected on February 27th, 2025, I knew that what I wanted to do was something going to be meaningful, something for sure in this space, because I am a Jewish legislator and, I am in the riding of Eglinton Lawrence the rise of anti-Semitism is something I deal with each and every day. As you know, I'm sure a lot of people are aware that, you know, every day that there has been something just even outside my office, there are police officers there. There's a synagogue. Synagogues have been shot at. Jewish owned businesses have been shot at. There has been a lot of intimidation on the streets here. And It's become not the Ontario I grew up in and not the city I grew up in. So I knew there has to be something, and I couldn't, nobody hands you anything when you're looking, you're kind of doing this consultation process to figure out what it is that you can do. So through lots of consultation, and people kept saying you should do this and this and all these things. But I will tell you what spark this, you know, this idea to me was I went with the Attorney General to Toronto Police Hate Crime Unit. And I did meet with the hate crime unit and saw what was happening and the challenges they were facing. So, you know, it really opened my mind to thinking, you know what, this is a gap. And they brought forward, there was a gap in our system. There was a gap in what we could be doing provincially. And I always say that there's, you know, there are three levels of government and not everybody knows what's in each other's toolbox, but provincially, there's certain tools we have. And so this was a gap provincially of something that we could do. And they did bring it forward and we did have a conversation around it. And, you know, I know a lot of people don't realize, but Toronto Police, after October 7th, 2023, they started this hate crime unit. And I think they started with only like four officers. And as of last year, they were up to almost 30 non-officers, investigators, full-time investigators investigating hate crime because of the increase in it.
There's been a huge amount of finger pointing among the various levels and jurisdictions. The cops say that the prosecutors drop the charges. The prosecutors say the law is not strong enough. And a lot of people say, like, just enforce the laws that are there. In terms of having special prosecutors, how are they going to be chosen or vetted? There's been some, hints. People are saying that, well, some prosecutors are ideologically opposed to this, whatever.
So this has been implemented. I can't talk to how they've chosen those people. That comes through the Ministry of Attorney General's office, the vetting process and who they're choosing to be in these roles. I just know that what I've been advised of, that they are senior crowns, crowns who want to be in this space, crowns with the expertise, because prior to this, that, this was being done off the side of someone's desk. So besides all the other, pieces of people coming forward, and the cases that they were working, they were also working these. And sometimes it would go to a junior crown and someone with the expertise. And as we know that the criminal code, which is federal, that is quite complex. Hate crime is complex. And to prosecute these, it takes them with the level of knowledge and dedication to take these to trial. And so what this unit does is it has a dedicated person, not someone off the side of their desk, dedicated, and the resource there to, and the specialty in the space to take this to trial. But just also they will have the relationship with the police that they consult pre and post charging, so that the police do the investigation, that they have, you know, they've done the proper investigation, so that they, when they do hand it to the Crown, who has that expertise and the dedication, that they will take it to trial. And this will ultimately create stronger case law for us here in Ontario and in Canada. So this is what this is about. It is about creating the case law that we need so that we hold people accountable in for hate crime in Ontario.
Another thing that really mystified me this week. So normally when the government does anything, especially something that appeals to a particular constituency, they trumpet it. There are government news releases. There are on-camera availabilities. It's like the thing's been in witness protection. It's not been picked up by regular media, except for us. And it seems like, you know, people want to keep it quiet.
Well, I'm here and I'm promoting it and I'm speaking about it. And I'm honored that you have had me on your show to talk about it. And, you know, I have put it out on our channels. I know the Attorney General has put it out. And look, I welcome any opportunity because I'm pretty proud of what we've done as a government. I mean, this is with, I can't do this in a silo. This is with my, the Premier Doug Ford's support behind this. This is with, you know, all of my caucus members' support behind this. And in conjunction with the Attorney General Doug Downey and the ministry. So I'm really proud to be sitting here and talking about it because it is much needed in this province. And it's something we have done as a government. I know a lot of people say, you know, words are not enough these days. There's action. Well, I've taken that action. And that's what this is about.
And final question. This happened very quickly. How did you get it done so quickly?
So I'm pretty focused. If you know me, I'm all about getting things done. And just, you know what, I had these dates in terms of April 16th is when I spoke and debated about this Motion 58 in the House, and then just really worked with the ministry. And they were eager to get this done, too, and our government. And so just, you know, follow up. We, you know what, and just sometimes the squeaky wheel gets things over the finish line quick.
And when will the unit actually be ready? I mean, is it working today or is it?
It is ready. And that is why I was, you know, proud on Monday to stand with the Attorney General. And he announced that this is working. And so Ontario is taking a leadership role in this in the entire country. He's already had other provinces reach out to speak to him about how we did this. And so hopefully this other provinces will learn from this and implement these types of units throughout the country.
Which other provinces?
I'd have to ask him. Okay. I'm not really sure of the details, but he did announce this on Monday when we were announcing it.
Okay, Michelle Cooper, thanks for being with us. We're all very hopeful about this, and congratulations for getting it done.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me here today.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye.
Okay, we are going to take another break. And when we come back, we'll talk about the meteor shower, the Perseid meteor shower, which reaches its peak tonight. Oh, and by the way, there's an eclipse and it's going to happen, in a few minutes, like around 12:55, but it's not really going to be very visible here, only 8%. And do not look at it anyway, unless you have the right equipment. So we'll gaze at the stars when we come back.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio, heard weekdays from noon to one. Fight Back with Libby Znaimer on Zoomer Radio.
Welcome back. Well, turning our attention now to the rest of the universe. Today is the day for both a total eclipse and the Perseid meteor shower. The eclipse will only be marginally visible here, 8%, and you'll still need special eyewear to look at it. And that's going to be happening in about 9 minutes. It is apparently a great year for the annual Perseid meteor shower, which will hit its peak tonight. Between tonight and the early hours of Thursday morning, when as many as 50 to 100 meteors per hour could be visible under ideal conditions, and that is according to NASA. So how can we best see this? And let's find out a little more about it. I'm going to give the numbers out again, 416-360-0740, 866-744-740. That's our text line and our long distance phone line. And right now I am joined by Rupinder Brar, who is a senior teaching professor of physics and astronomy at Ontario Tech University. Professor, thanks so much for being with us.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
Okay, so first of all, tell us, what is this annual Perseid meteor shower?
So the name itself is kind of funny because when we think of a meteor shower, we think, oh, there must be a lot of different meteors entering into our atmosphere and burning up. But funny enough, it actually has to do with us going through a comet's trail. And so there's this one comet called Swift-Tuttle, and it passes through the inner part of our solar system every 133 years. And so the last time it did this was 1992. And when comets come very close to the inner part of the solar system, they start to melt, and little bits and pieces of them fall off and stay there in space. And so when Earth is minding its own business, going around the sun as it always does, once a year, it'll actually pass through that trail. Almost think of it as leaving little breadcrumbs in space made of things like dust and metals and rocks. And then when those little tiny bits hit the atmosphere of the Earth, they're traveling so fast that the friction with the atmosphere just vaporizes them. And we get this beautiful long-tailed meteor that, some people it would describe it as that comet shape, where it's like this fireball in the sky that lasts just 1 second, maybe 2 seconds, but I think is really a beautiful sight to behold.
How did it get its name?
So the Swift-Tuttle comet was named after the two people that discovered it, not in 1992 actually, but 133 years before that. And astronomers have the ability to just observe comets in space and sort of predict what their orbit is going to look like. And so Swift and Tuttle, back in the late 1800s, if my mid 1800s, I think if my math is correct, each independently saw the comet, and if you look at it over a number of different nights, they're able to calculate its trajectory. It goes behind the sun, and then it actually spends most of its life in the far reaches of the solar system, beyond where our telescopes can see it. We can't see Swift-Tuttle right now, but in about 100 years from now, it'll make its way back into the inner part of the solar system where the Earth and the Sun and the other inner planets live.
Why is it called the Perseid meteor shower?
Right. And so when we talk about the meteor showers themselves, we usually name them after the part of the sky that they're going to be emanating from. And so the Perseus constellation is kind of centered in it. It doesn't really have anything to do with the stars of the Perseus constellation. The stars are far away from us, but it's that direction that the Earth is kind of heading into that meteor shower, and so you'll be best to look in that direction. Now, most of us can't identify Perseus in the sky, but there are a couple of constellations I think we all can easily identify. For example, the Big Dipper. Another easy one is Cassiopeia. It's just basically that W in the sky. And so tonight or Thursday night, if you go out and you're looking for the Perseid meteor shower, I encourage you to go out as late as possible, as you can handle. Go out around midnight if you can, 1 a.m., and look in the northern direction, about northeast. You'll see the Big Dipper over there. You'll see Cassiopeia, the W, like I said. And somewhere around that direction will be the Perseus constellation. And you don't really have to find it exactly because these meteorites can be so flashy and so distinctive that even if you're not staring right at it, your peripheral vision will soon catch it and you'll turn in the right direction. So don't stress too much about looking at exactly the right place. In general, go out in the middle of the night, face north, and as long as your sky is clear and the night sky is not cloudy, you should be able to see quite a few of them.
Is it going to be visible in the city? What are the places in Ontario or the GTA where we can best see this?
Yeah, and so if I was in the city itself, I would try to get away from it if possible. The light pollution that emanates from the Greater Toronto Area is significant, and what that does, it is obscures the night sky for us, which is, really a shame. We should be trying to get away and enjoy the night sky every once in a while. So right now, I myself am near Algonquin Park, pretty close to South River, Ontario. And I've been going out the last 2 nights. We've had very, very clear skies. I can see thousands of stars. I can see the Milky Way. And each of these nights, I have seen numerous sort of early meteor showers coming in. And so even last night, I saw this very, very strong fireball across the sky, and it was wonderful. It's not something that happens over such a short period of time. Whether you get out tonight, you get out the next night, you should be able to at least see a few of them. But the peak time I would recommend would be as late as possible tonight into the early morning, if you're up for it.
If we're up for it, and how does weather affect the visibility?
Yeah, so weather plays a really, really big part. Clearly, if you have large cloud cover, you're not going to see anything. But even if it's a little bit foggy or misty, that can obscure some of the more fainter comets as well. And I'm no meteorologist, but I do believe there is a forecast for some fog in the morning. And so my recommendation is just to get out about midnight tonight, looking at the forecast. Again, I'm no expert, but hopefully clear skies await us in and around midnight tonight.
Okay, and this eclipse is coming up in about a minute, actually, but I don't think it's going to have an impact on the sky here. It's only in Toronto. It's only going to be an 8% eclipse. What can you tell us about it, though?
Yeah, and so this is a total solar eclipse, just not for us. It's an interesting phenomenon that we can all hopefully remember back to 2024. And I don't know where you were, but I made sure to get out to Lake Erie, and I had nice clear skies for what was a spectacular total solar eclipse a couple of years back. Well, now it's not our turn. This total solar eclipse is going through Portugal, Spain, and Iceland. And if you're further away from the path of totality, less and less of the sun is obscured. So our fellow Canadians in Newfoundland are experiencing probably about 65% coverage today, which is pretty nice. But in Ontario, we're only at about 8%. And so most people will not even notice. 8% does not, it's not even a equivalent of a cloud going in front of the sun. But for those that are very, very keen to see a small piece of the sun obscured, remember that it is unsafe to look at an eclipse without proper equipment. However, many of us did have proper equipment just 2 years ago. And so if you do have some official solar eclipse glasses lying around from 2024, be very careful. Look very carefully along the edges. Make sure that there's no punctures, no holes, nothing like that. And then, in about an hour from now, when it reaches maximum eclipse, head out outside and see that little bite taken out of the sun.
Yeah, I do remember. We ended up in a spot in Burlington because there was a lot of traffic, and it was still quite fabulous, even though we didn't get total totality, but it was still quite fabulous and feels really quite spiritual.
I completely agree. As a scientist who knew exactly what was happening, what the science behind that was, as soon as totality hit and I could lay my eyes on the corona of the sun, it was an otherworldly experience.
Yeah, so less so now, and Yeah, I think it's a little bit late to be looking for those two-year-old eclipse glasses anyway. I mean, who knows where they are now?
I've got them in my backpack, so I'll be out there anyway.
You'll be out there. You are prepared. Anything else that you would like to tell us about the meteor shower since we have a little bit more time? Now, of course, for that, you don't need equipment. You just go and lie down.
Absolutely. It's completely safe. Just make sure you maybe take some bug spray if you get out. If you really, really can't escape the city, I would think that you could find a dark park or something like that. Maybe get out, into northern Durham region, somewhere near our Rouge Park or something along those lines. You'd have a chance to see some of the brighter meteors in that location. But if you can get, a good half hour, 45 minutes north of those city lights, you'll see much, much more. The other thing I'd love to just talk about is kind of our connection. Like, we're always, so focused on our own lives, on what's happening around us. To see a meteor shower and connect that with the fact that we live on this planet and we're hurtling through space at high speeds. That's what you're seeing. You're seeing us moving around the sun and going through a field of small little dust particles in space. It really, I think, connects us to more than just our own lives, that we have this shared experience of us hurtling through space in this larger universe that we live in.
Yeah, I have to say it is great to hear your passion on this. And it's a great reminder, especially, here on the show, we focus so much on developments that are day to day, week to week, a reminder that there's something bigger than we are. And take a deep breath and just appreciate it. I think that's a very, very good thing for all of us. And Rupinder Brar, thank you so much for being with us and enjoy your celestial events tonight.
Thank you so much.
Okay, bye-bye.
Goodbye.
That is all the time we have for Fight Back for today. Follow us on YouTube. Follow us on Instagram. I'll be back here tomorrow, and we'll talk then.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio. Heard weekdays from noon to one. This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show.